Good evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon, and for the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. This is Friday, so it's Roundtable Day. I have a great panel for you here in store. My first guest is a politician and educator. She was a member of the Hampton, Virginia City Council from 1996 to 2004, mayor of Hampton from 2000 to 2004. And since 2004, she's been a member of the Senate of Virginia from the 2nd District. She's also professor of political science at Hampton University, my alma mater, even though I went to the Institute. Dr. Mamie Locke, greetings, good evening, and welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you, ma'am. I really appreciate it. We are also joined by a journalist and political analyst focusing his coverage on U.S. foreign policy and the global system of monopoly capitalism and imperialism, Caleb Maupin. Caleb, welcome back.
Glad to be here, as always.
We are also joined, last but not least, my guest is a PhD student in the Department of Communication, Culture, and Media Studies at Howard University School of Communication. He's been a TV news reporter for more than 20 years as a senior Washington, D.C. correspondent. Since 2008, he's been a reporter at large covering two presidencies, Congress, and State Departments. Colin Campbell, as always, welcome back.
Happy holidays, Dr. Leon. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. And let me say to all three of you, it's the Friday before the holiday. I know each of you are making great sacrifices with your families to participate in this program, and I sincerely, sincerely appreciate it. So we are now into day six of the partial government shutdown. It goes into full effect next week. Let me just start with the general question. Dr. Mamie Locke, your thoughts on where we are right now?
Oh, I think that this is truly a travesty to the American people that we would even have gotten here because of a temper tantrum on the part of the president of the United States. Because he can't have his way. We have federal employees who are out of work and then those who are forced to work without getting paid because they are essential employees, all because he wants to build a wall between the United States and Mexico. This is absolutely ridiculous. You know, why are we even at this point when he's been told over and over again that 53% of the American people do not want this wall? He's been told that the wall is not going to be built, is not going to be put in the budget. So why are we even here?
He's also been told that it wouldn't work.
Exactly.
Caleb Maupin, your thoughts.
Well, you know, you mentioned sacrifices that we are making to be here. My goodness, think of what government employees are going through right now. You know, penniless holidays. I mean, the horror stories are out there. And the scariest part of all of this is there doesn't seem to be any end in sight. This wall is not realistic. People have looked over the plan for the big, beautiful wall, the big, giant wall that Trump talked about. It's not a realistic plan, so I really doubt people are just going to give in and give him money to build something that can't really be built. Meanwhile, this is quite scary. I mean, we've seen gridlock in Washington, D.C. That's been the name of the game for the last decade or so. We know that there's division among the elite circles of power in the United States like never before, not just among the rich and the wealthy corporations, but also among different government agencies and the military and such. But this is unprecedented. This is something extreme. Some people speculated that maybe Trump just wanted to get his name in the headlines and get Americans talking about him over the holiday season, but he's drawing this out quite a bit. And I don't really see an end in sight, and I'm worried about the future of our country.
Well, I was talking about him when he asked that 7-year-old girl if she was serious about Santa Claus. He didn't have to go to this extent. But Colin Campbell, your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, let's put it in perspective here. How many people can be affected by all this? We have more than 400,000 people affected by this. The Smithsonian Museums are saying that they will stay open until the 1st, but after that, they will be shut down. This is definitely going to affect people going on vacation, coming to D.C. to see all the sites and the museums during the holiday season before they return to their regularly scheduled programming at the top of 2019. If we look back in 2013, for example, the shutdown during the Obama administration. It was estimated that it cost about $2 billion in productivity for the United States. So this shutdown, if it's prolonged, could cost Americans millions of dollars every day. That's our taxpayer dollars being wasted as we try to make up for the shortfalls of the government agencies that will be affected. We're talking Department of Treasury, Department of Agriculture, Homeland Security Department, Department of Interior, Department of State, Housing and Urban Development, where we know there's been some controversy there over rates rising for their low-income residents there, Department of Transportation, Department of Commerce, Department of Justice, and other thousands of employees will be affected by this shutdown. As to one of your guests said, it was really all this amounts to is an extreme temper tantrum. Many experts have said the wall wouldn't be effective. And of course, he is trying to be more desperate because he knows once Democrats take over the House in January, it's going to be that much harder to get exactly what he wants. Schumer, the leadership in Democratic leadership in the Senate, has already presented several different ideas that the president has all shut down, all in the search and trying to get this $5 billion. Now, what could happen is a lesser sum that the president could agree to, so he could still say he won, that he'll get some kind of something built, and then Democrats could say they won, that they didn't say they didn't acquiesce giving $5 billion to this wall, or they could come up with a different border security plan. As it is right now, the CBP is already being affected by this partial shutdown, and it could be even more severe if they don't come to an agreement. But it doesn't look like the Democrats are going to just fold, because they know they have an upper hand in some of the power brokering here. And the president wants to show that he's the tough, almighty president that's going to get what he wants no matter what. So he wants to have a win, too. So it's going to be a very protracted ordeal, especially when Pelosi gavels in January, because I think that she knows that this all depends on, this is going to be a reflection on her leadership as well, what's negotiated. So this, we could be in for a long haul, especially because the two sides are so polarized on this issue as to what really should be happening and what's the most productive way to come to a compromise.
The AP has reported that incoming acting chief of staff Mick Mulvaney said Democrats are no longer negotiating with the administration over an offer made back on Saturday to accept less than the $5 billion that Trump wants for his wall along the U.S.-Mexico border. Now, Democrats said, and again, this is AP earlier today, said that the White House offered $2.5 billion for border security, but that Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer told Mike Pence that that wasn't acceptable. Colin, we've gone from $5 billion to $2.5 billion, and I think initially they said for border wall. Now the language in the AP report is border security.
Security, of course. And of course, we have to know exactly what that means. That could still mean that even though the White House is saying, okay, we don't want $5 billion for a wall, we want $2.5 billion for border security, which would include a partial building of some wall or a smaller wall. We don't know exactly what's going on in that $2.5 billion, but we do know that border security isn't just a big, beautiful wall to take from the president. Border security is also people, personnel at the border. It's also having the right people on hand to surveil the border, the people on hand to make sure that there are ports of entry that are open, to make sure that people are coming in legally in the most productive ways possible. There have been suggestions that there could be drone coverage of certain areas that remain without specific coverage. I mean, there are lots of things that go into border protection. Some have talked about increasing personnel at the border crossing so that more cars can be inspected coming in. I know that Democrats are very responded to this idea because they believe that not enough cars are being inspected, which means that more drugs could be coming in. And of course, we've heard the president talk about his concern about the influx of drugs coming in from immigrants, whether or not that's exaggerated. We can have a debate on that. But that is something he's talked about. That is something that Democrats have talked about. Perhaps this is an area where they could come to a compromise. in order to put a budget together, in order to come up with a comprehensive plan to increase border security. But it's very clear, Democrats do not want this big wall. The president does want this big wall, but there's so much in between that they can negotiate on, and that's where I think a lot of lawmakers are looking for some type of compromise.
Dr. Mamie Locke Mulvaney says, hey, we came down to $2.5 million for security, and Chuck Schumer tells Pence that ain't working.
What do we not hear them talking about? We do not hear them talking about the fact that we have kids dying that are coming across the border. We don't hear them talking about, what are you going to do about these kids that are still in these camps? We heard that one was supposed to be closing. Now we hear that that same camp is still going to be open. What are you going to do about these children? You know, we hear them talking about taking people to bus stations and then just releasing them without any place for them to go. We're at this impasse without any kind of real discussions about, you know, what do we mean by security, as, you know, just stated. You know, I don't even think the president knows in his mind, you know, what he means by security. He's just talking to that 33% of his base, you know, who probably don't even know what security means to them. You know, they hear him having said that he was going to build a wall and that Mexico was going to pay for it. Whatever happened to that, because Mexico said, no, we're not. I mean, he's talking to that 33% of his base. He let talking heads on the far right talk him out of signing an agreement because he has no real political will of his own to do the right thing ever. And as a result, that's why we're where we are right now.
And Kayla Maupin, to Dr. Locke's point about children dying, it must also be stated that children were dying in U.S. custody during the Obama administration. And it's also important, to be fair, that early on in this process, the pictures that they were showing of children being housed with the silver blankets and all that, those were photographs from the Obama administration, not originally photographs of children that were being detained under the Trump administration. But with that said, I come back to you and say again, Mulvaney says we'll take $2.5 billion for border security. And the Democrats are saying, we're not going to give you a slush fund.
Well, I mean, it's not just the pictures of immigrant children. I mean, we also know that there's been a reel of footage that they've been showing on MSNBC the last few days of Border Patrol agents dumping out water left for migrants in the desert, kicking over water, dumping it out so that it's harder for these migrants because they can't get water. Well, that video footage is from 2011. Those Border Patrol agents who were doing that were accountable to Barack Obama's administration, not to the administration of Trump. And we should be clear on that. And I think it's also important to point out that, I mean, that there is a crisis on the U.S. border. I mean, if you go down there, the fact is there are lots of people coming into the United States, and they find bodies every day of people trying to cross the border, and that there is kind of an epidemic, and this is something that needs to be addressed. Now, obviously, I don't think the answer is a big giant wall, but folks that want to just say, oh, this is just great, this is just the American dream, people coming to a new land, let's just applaud. No, I mean, there is a big issue that people in Central America and Mexico and other places, there's a humanitarian crisis with people fleeing, and there are real issues that need to be addressed. Those issues tend to be in the countries of origin, where people are living under governments that are corrupt and tied in with Wall Street and very repressive and tied in with drug cartels and all of that. And that side of the conversation doesn't really show up in a lot of what we're seeing. I mean, I feel like there are forces that have latched on to this particular issue to criticize and rightly criticize the Trump administration, but they're not really, you know, putting things in the overall context. They're trying to kind of pluck emotional heartstrings in order to go after a particular president and his policies, which are problematic. And I think that the narrative of mainstream media is lacking in context.
I'm going to put this question to the three of you, and then we're going to go into a break. And I'm going to try, I want to, what I call triangulate this next issue. Most people see this as a two-sided issue, Republicans versus Democrats. I see this quickly developing into three sides, if it has not already: Trump, the Democrats, and the Republicans. Trump playing to his base, as Dr. Locke so aptly mentioned earlier, Trump playing to his base, he sees an advantage. Democrats see this as a Trump shutdown since he claimed ownership of the crisis 2 weeks ago. Where are most Republicans in the House and in the Senate? Are they siding with the titular head of their party? Or are they slowly starting to put pressure on him to be more reasonable and to give in? Colin, quickly, I'll come to you, and then I'll go to Dr. Locke and Caleb.
Yeah, I think as time goes on and pressure from the how this partial government shutdown is exacerbated, we will see Republicans trying to come to more of a negotiating factor with Democrats. I think that the president really wants to put into place his policy that he has talked about since the beginning of the campaign, even though Mexico is not going to pay for it, even though taxpayers will most likely fit the bill, even though he's trying to even introduce fuzzy math into trade negotiations to talk about how this wall could easily be funded. I think that the true pressure from the outcry from people who aren't getting paid, workers who may be furloughed, services that will be closed down, Democrats putting the pressure on, we'll start to see Republicans saying, listen, we need to come to a more negotiated stance, and they will peel away from the president to some degree. Now, there are going to be some who are going to stick with the president and say that he should play hardball, that he does have the upper hand. But I think those who are a little bit more moderate, we're going to see them wanting the president to negotiate away from that $5 billion wall that he really, really wants.
And Caleb, yesterday afternoon, the House went into a pro forma session, and Representative Jim McGovern, the Democrat from Massachusetts, who's the incoming Rules Committee chairman, tried to bring up a Senate-passed bill to reopen the government, and they did not even allow him to speak. Caleb, your thoughts?
Well, I think that your point about there being three different positions on this issue rather than just two is pretty correct. If you look at it, you know, Ted Cruz, for example, you know, the U.S. Senator from Texas, he articulates quite a different position on immigration than Trump does. Now, he doesn't advocate building this huge wall, but, you know, he's certainly not, you know, not advocating that we loosen the restrictions or pass legalization. And that you can really say that this kind of this Trump movement or Trump wing of the Republican Party is a little bit distinct from the Republican Party at large. There's this faction that's very, very concerned about immigration, very, very concerned about trade deals. The America First Republicans, you could call them. A lot of them were Ron Paulers at one point, and fans of Ron Paul and libertarianism. A lot of them were the kind of people that were going to the Tea Party rallies, and the rest of the Republican Party isn't necessarily in lockstep with them. Now, I'm sure most Republicans would take the side of President Trump against the Democrats, but Trump seems to be doing his own thing and appealing to a particular faction. You know, I mean, you know, you could call them the Roy Moore Republicans, perhaps, or the Steve Bannon Republicans. But he is appealing to his base, but that base is not necessarily representative of the entire Republican Party. And I think there are different interests. But you know, the Democratic Party is also pretty divided. And you know, what the folks that are gathering around Bernie Sanders and Tulsi Gabbard want, and what the folks gathered around Hillary Clinton and Michael Bloomberg and others want is also a divide. And I think that politics in the USA is diversifying.
Folks, you are listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. This is Friday, and this is panel time. And we are very blessed to have with us Dr. Mamie Locke, professor of political science from Hampton University. We have with us journalist and political analyst Caleb Maupin, as well as journalist Colin Campbell. And again, I want to thank them. I know they're all giving you as an audience time away from their holiday with their families to do this interview, and I greatly, greatly appreciate it. There's more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and it is Friday. You are tuned to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. And since it's Friday, it's my roundtable with Dr. Mamie Locke, professor of political science from Hampton University, Caleb Maupin, journalist and political analyst, as well as journalist extraordinaire Colin Campbell, and there's an awful lot of border security and border talk issues for this week. The president has threatened to shut down the southern border as this government funding stalemate drags on. Today, he issued a string of tweets in which he again vowed to close the entire U.S. border with Mexico and halt aid to several Latin American countries unless Democrats agree to his demand for billions of dollars in wall funding. Colin Campbell, if he were to shut down the border, auto parts could not get through, which means General Motors and Chrysler and Dodge, they wouldn't be too happy. Refrigerators that are assembled in Mexico, all types of consumer products that are televisions that are assembled in Mexico would not be able to get through. Is this a veiled threat? Or, I mean, not veiled threat. Is this an idle threat? Or do you think that he would seriously make a move?
I think that this is more of an idle threat because, like I said, if President Trump, this would really have disastrous implications for a reelection campaign, especially if the economy continues to erode under a partial government shutdown. Like I talked about before, up to a billion could be lost every day. And even though the president makes this idle threat, it might partially come true regardless because, like I said before, if this shutdown continues, there will be staff and workers from Customs and Border Protection who are affected by the shutdown. Now, it's possible that they'll keep working without pay in hopes that they will get remunerated later on. But how long would that go on? And if that does happen, would there be some that would be put on temporary leave because of the fact that they're not getting payment right away? Those issues would definitely have to be looked at. So even though he may not shut down the border entirely, we could say that the border could be compromised regardless if this does continue. Now, we've seen the implications. We've seen the stock market take a tumble in recent weeks. We've seen we know that a partial government shutdown could erode the economy. All of these things together will seriously erode the confidence that some people have in the president in improving the economy and keeping people working and keeping the GDP escalating. All of those things will be compromised, and one of the president's key marketing points about himself will definitely be compromised, definitely not be any longer true, and he'll have to recalibrate exactly how far he wants to take this if he wants to keep his credibility as someone who is good for the U.S. economy.
Dr. Locke, to that question about Trump threatening to shut down the southern border, to Colin's point, what's happened to the guy that's the master of the art of the deal?
I mean, in so many ways, he is the master of idle threats. And actually just throwing things out there and will then deny that he ever said it. And he is certainly not an individual who is a master of making any kind of deals. He is incapable of even trying to make deals because he gets too angry and frustrated when he can't get his way. And we see right now what happens when he doesn't get his way.
Dr. Locke, let me also throw in there that governing is a whole lot different than managing a real estate empire. And there's no, because everything for him is a one-off. Everything for him is transactional. And on the governing side, you need a vision. You need an agenda that these various pieces become a part of a bigger puzzle. So to your point, not only is his disposition a huge problem in the negotiation, but there seems to be no grand strategy.
And he doesn't even understand the process of governing or the process of policymaking. He thought that when he was running for president that he could bring this business acumen into the White House. If I know how to make a deal, I'll know how to make public policy in the same manner. This is not the same process, and that you do have to understand compromising with members of the legislative branch, which he clearly does not understand.
Caleb, to that point, I'll also add, I don't think he ever really intended to be president. I think he ran because he was planning with Roger Ailes and what's his name, the other guy is that left the White House early, to form a news network further to the right of Fox, Steve Bannon. I believe that that's why he surrounded himself with Steve Bannon and Roger Ailes, is because he was planning to generate enough interest from the campaign to launch a pay-per-view conservative television network and make millions of dollars a month with people paying fees to listen to him spew what he spews. Caleb Maupin, your thoughts?
That's certainly one theory. And I mean, we may never actually know. A lot of people have looked at the Trump campaign. There's been speculation. Did he do it on a whim? What exactly was going on? How far did he want to push it? But I mean, it was an experiment that seemed to work. I mean, and the more that he campaigned, the more people seemed to like what he had to say. And he ultimately took the White House. And there are other people that look into it and say that was his plan all along, and that any speculation otherwise is just inaccurate. And we're never really going to know.
We've been in
meetings. We aren't behind closed doors.
But your thoughts on the original question about him threatening to shut down?
Well, I mean, that's the interesting thing. Now, in the short term, if you were to shut down the U.S. border, that would have catastrophic economic consequences, right? Products wouldn't be getting across. A lot of economic activity would come to a halt. A lot of trade would be stopping. But if you think about it, if you think about this in a long term, right? I mean, the fact that so many people from Mexico are fleeing to the United States, part of that is because they used to have a huge agricultural sector in Mexico. Used to be a lot of Mexican farmers. And then NAFTA was signed, and American agribusiness, subsidized by the American taxpayers, was able to undercut them. And now Mexico is mainly reliant on food imported from the United States. And when it comes to aid to these Central American countries, a lot of left-wing activists, progressive people, trade unionists, have been calling for the U.S. government to cut off aid to Honduras for a long time. Because that government is the result of a coup that came into power in 2009, at the toppling of the socialist Manuel Zelaya. You can look at Guatemala. It's a similar situation, where that government is presiding over a lot of corruption. And there have been a lot of people that have called for U.S. aid to Guatemala to be cut off. And we're not talking far right wing isolationists. We're talking progressive activists that say stop facilitating these narco states that do business with Wall Street. So, I think if you think about it, in the short term, it would be catastrophic. But the fact that he's even threatening to do it shows that there are a lot of people that are frustrated with this in this global low wage free market economy it's been bad for the developing world for a long time. But now, in the last few decades, it's gotten to be particularly bad for people in the first world as well. And that, the rule of these big international financial entities like the World Bank and the IMF and the World Trade Organization, that basically have the ability to overturn labor laws and legislation that countries would pass, there's a lot wrong with that. And I don't think you have to be a Trump guy. You don't have to be Steve Bannon to critique it. I think a lot of left-wing folks would share those criticisms.
But Caleb, if you go back a little further in history, and if you pick up Stephen Kinzer's book, Overthrow, then the United States history in overturning democratically elected governments in Honduras, in Guatemala, in El Salvador, that the United States since the 50s has been knee deep in undermining these elected governments at the behest of United Fruit Company and so many other corporate interests. So the United States has been decimating these politics and decimating these economies for years.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, go back to just a couple weeks ago, we had the passing of the NECA Act, which was essentially an effort to try and sabotage the economy of Nicaragua. And it was just horrendous sanctions put on Nicaragua, basically an effort to try and foment economic suffering in Nicaragua, the Central American country, because we don't approve of the socialist government that the people of Nicaragua have elected. And that socialist government has actually had some very, very good economic results. I mean, their GDP growth has been very high. They've reduced poverty. And actually, the World Happiness Index said that of all countries in the world, the highest growth in happiness in 2016 was in Nicaragua. And Nicaragua is partnering with China. They're talking about building a new canal that would serve as kind of an alternative to the Panama Canal, which is controlled by the United States. And now we've targeted the government of Nicaragua, and we're trying to make the economy scream, as Nixon said when he was targeting the government of Chile. So there's a whole history of U.S. meddling in Central America and South America, and that plays a huge role in the crisis that we're seeing.
And, Carlin, we can look at Venezuela and what the United States is doing there. We can look at what the United States is trying to, well, has done in Brazil. Steve Bannon was one of the masterminds behind Bolsonaro coming to power in Brazil. And so the narrative is warped in terms of what Americans are understanding in terms of why so many of these people are trying to come to the United States. I was reading a piece about 2 weeks ago about global warming and the impact that that's had on the Honduran coffee market and our coffee farmers. And coffee farmers in Honduras are now going dry, and they're coming here trying to find a better life. Climate change. Colin Campbell.
Yeah, thank you. I actually, before I jump into that, with something that we call ecological gentrification, we have to look at U.S. historically as far as governments they've overthrown. Like you mentioned, there was Brazil, but we also can look at Iran. We can look at Congo. We can look at Dominican Republic, South Vietnam, and we can look at Chile. I mean, there is a history of the U.S. influencing other governments to topple whoever those powers are at that time to fit U.S. interests. And I think that's why the world is watching how the U.S. is operating and why certain countries have concerns whenever the U.S. has military bases near them, whenever they are putting lots of money into governments, whatever their influences are, whenever they're trying to negotiate deals. There has been a history throughout the decades of the U.S. toppling governments. And yes, on that issue of coffee farmers going dry, coffee bean growers going dry, there are other disastrous impacts that climate change has had throughout the world, and it's usually developing nations that are struggling with trying to mitigate the impact that they are having on their industries. This is not just in Central America and South America, but it's also in the Caribbean. And what I talked about when I'm talking about ecological gentrification, for example, is when you look at climate change and the volatile effects of nature taking their tolls on developing nations. Let's look specifically at Antigua and Barbuda. In Barbuda, that island was basically decimated. 90% of it was wiped out. All of their residents had to move to their sister island of Antigua. But what's happening? You have these investors coming from the United States. One we're all familiar with, Robert De Niro, who is a very vociferous Trump critic. But at the same time, he wants to invest millions of dollars to open a casino in Barbuda. Well, what does that mean? That means that people who have lived there for generations, families who have inhabited that island, may be displaced in the interest of big money. When we're looking at this neoliberalization of how people are affected by climate change and how the U.S. is right now, this administration has been either removed or very silent or at the very least very skeptical of the effects and detrimental impacts that climate change can have on developing nations. It really makes people frustrated, especially those who are directly impacted by the effects of leading world nations creating the situations and the environmental changes that would adversely impact them, and then they're reliant on all these other outside sources, or they just struggle with daily life because they can't make a living. They may not have a place to live, and a lot of it is because of the already developed nations just trying to make more money without any consideration to developing nations that are strongly affected by these impacts.
Dr. Locke, as we're going into the break, ICE dumps hundreds of migrants with nowhere to go at a bus station on Christmas Eve without warning the shelters. Hundreds of asylum seekers spent part of Christmas Eve in a downtown parking lot in El Paso, Texas, without knowing where they'll end up next. Lawmakers and immigrant rights groups scrambled after ICE released these migrants. Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents began dropping off the migrants late last Sunday at a local bus station. Mm-hmm. And about 200 arrived on Sunday, 200 more Monday. And they're saying that there were maybe almost 1,000 by this past Wednesday. That's according to Beto O'Rourke. You know, I thought that these migrants, that they were thieves and that they were rapists and that they were the scourge of the earth and carrying drugs and disease and vermin and plague and all other types of craziness. But now they're just dropping them off at the bus station.
According to the president of the United States, in a campaign speech, that's what they were. Now you the only thing you can do is just drop them off and just say, okay, have at it.
I thought these people had to be processed. I thought that these people had to be deported. I thought that the democracy is being undermined because we've got these caravans of crazed migrants coming to the United States, and now we just drop them off at the Greyhound bus station.
Their very existence here in this country, and but you just drop them off, you know, have at it, you know, go have a good life. But to get back to the climate change issue, the only thing that you can say is it doesn't exist. And because you can say it doesn't exist, there's no such thing, you know, as global warming. You can have deniability that, you know, all of these things are happening because of human factors that, you know, they're the cause, not us. We didn't had nothing to do with it. You know, we didn't rape and pillage and cause these things to happen. You know, it's their fault, you know, and because we don't believe in the science and we don't believe in, you know, global warming and climate change, you know, it must be their fault that all of these things are happening to them.
Well, I know this. In my beloved state, home state of California, we've had the worst fire season. 2018 was the worst fire season in the history of the state. It's been in about a 15-year drought. And Trump's answer was, well, you should have raked more leaves. And you should have you should have gotten rakes out in the forest and raked leaves to prevent the state from catching on fire. Hey, folks, Dr. Wimmer-Leon here, and you're listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. It is Friday, therefore it is Roundtable Day, and you are very fortunate to be hearing the voice of political science professor at Hampton University, my alma mater, Dr. Mamie Locke. You're also hearing from journalist and political analyst Caleb Maupin, as well as journalist and PhD student in the Department of Communications at Howard University. That is Colin Campbell. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wimmer-Leon. Big shout out, Happy New Year, and to my Facebook friends and family, thank you all so much for tuning in. This is Friday. It is Roundtable Day. Professor of Political Science at Hampton University, Dr. Mamie Locke. We have journalist and political analyst Colin Campbell, and we have journalist and PhD student in the Department of Communications and Culture and Media Studies at Howard, Colin, I almost said Dr. Colin Campbell, soon to be Colin Campbell. Thank you all so much. See, I'm speaking it into existence, Colin.
That's right. I appreciate that.
Hey, man, that's what it takes. So President Trump took a secret trip to Iraq. He took a whirlwind secret trip to Iraq this week, but I think this has to be placed into some larger context of a week ago where the president hastily declared that he had defeated ISIS and that the U.S. would pull its troops out of Syria. The abrupt move was reportedly resisted by Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis, who appealed to the president to reconsider and then resigned when his request fell upon deaf ears. The president also failed to meet with any Iraqi officials while he was in the country, and I believe that Iraq is supposed to be a sovereign nation, which means you should have at least said hey to the president while you were there, despite the fact that the U.S. invaded Iraq in 2003 and has had a continuous troop presence there ever since. Caleb Maupin, your thoughts on Donald Trump's trip to Iraq, and but more importantly, the policy that he articulated while he was there by he didn't talk about bringing troops out of there.
Well, I mean, the way that whole trip was conducted and the way Mattis departed from the Trump administration, you know, Trump is really not winning many friends in the Pentagon right now. He seems to be almost going out of his way to offend the Pentagon brass. And this raises a lot of questions because it seems like, you know, a good rule for U.S. politics, at least during the Cold War, was that Democrats were closer to the intelligence agencies, Republicans were closer to the Pentagon and the military. And that was just kind of a basic way of understanding it. You know, the CIA was all about soft power and working behind the scenes and trying to make the USA look like Mr. Nice Guy, Mr. Friendly. And meanwhile, you know, the Pentagon, they were all about peace through strength and bomb them into the Stone Age and blow things up. But it seems like we have Trump, who is a Republican president, and he seems to have not only offended the intelligence agencies, he's really offended them. But now we see that he's also offending the Pentagon. And you have to wonder, I mean, what is his plan here? You know, if the Pentagon's going to be against him and the intelligence agencies are going to be against him, who's going to be for him? I mean, when you're the president of the United States, you have to work with people. You have to run the government of the United States. The government, that I will add, is now shut down. So I have a lot of questions about what is he really trying to achieve here? Is he just trying to make a lot of noise and get a lot of attention to himself? Is he just thinking, well, hey, I'm going to go down anyway. I'm going to go down fighting. I mean, what's the deal here? Because, I mean, you look at it and you think he's not got many friends on Capitol Hill.
Dr. Mamie Locke, to Colin's point, you alienate yourself from the hard power Pentagon and you alienate yourself from the soft power intelligence people. Nobody's got your back.
I think back to when he was running. Remember what he said? I know more than the generals.
I know more than the generals.
This is an individual who has absolutely no tact, no diplomacy, and truly, truly thinks that he knows more than anybody else. At the end of the day, he's going to be one of those people who's kind of out there on a limb by himself, and he's going to look back and see that there's nobody back there with him. You know, nobody there out there. He's going to be out there by himself. You know, nobody with him, because he's going to have absolutely no support except for that 33%. And that's because they all watch Fox News. And even Fox News is starting to question.
Now, that's a frightening thing, Colin Campbell, when Fox News is starting to scratch their heads and saying, huh?
Yeah, we're starting to see that one by one with their commentators and pundits, despite the proclivity to really support President Trump, are really starting to question and show their dubiousness over the president's policies and strategies as he kind of blunders his way through different situations. We already saw that the optics of the president's visit to Iraq were looking very sketchy and almost like a disaster when the narrative was starting to come out that he would be the first president not to visit troops while on deployment in years. And then, of course, they had to change that after the president kind of snuck into Baghdad, and then it became the first president not to visit troops before Christmas. And so already it was off on a rocky start. But then what the president is a master at doing, and a lot of people would disagree, and this isn't just my assessment, is making an event all about him. We saw troops getting their MAGA hats signed. We heard the president talk about how he had concerns over his safety, flying in through the cover of night in a darkened plane to land because, you know, it was so dangerous for him. Meanwhile, we have troops who are, you know, under fire almost daily, who are in very deleterious circumstances daily. But the president talked about how he had concerns about his own safety, even though he was only there for about 3 hours, bringing Melania, the first lady, with him, kind of slipping in and out, you know, out of Baghdad and leaving the troops there. But, you know, he made that moment to talk about how he was concerned about his safety. But what has also...
To that point, if he was so concerned about his safety and he brought his wife with him, I'd have left my wife in Germany. I'll pick you up on the way back through Germany, because this is going to be a pretty rough and tumble day and I don't want to subject you to a surface-to-air missile. So...
Oh, yeah. Well, again, This isn't about Dr. Leon. Like I said, this isn't about the First Lady or his wife, who we would all think he loves very much. This is about him and him only. We've seen, of course, we're diverging a little bit, digressing, but we've seen how the president has treated Melania when it comes to when it rains. You know, he'll leave her in the rain and make sure he is definitely under the cover of an umbrella. We've seen the type of relationship when he tries to hold her hand and she kind of pushes it away. So it's very speculative just how much, to what degree he really cares about her. But really quickly, back on the Baghdad thing, he also did something that he's been very consistent with doing. Some people would call it, white lies. Some would say hyperbole. Some people would call
uber hyperbole.
Hyperbole. Right, exactly. Like alternative facts. Who knows? I can say that he told troops that he gave them a 10% raise. That's not true. He said that troops haven't gotten raises in years. That's also not true. So again, this is really what amounted to a 3-hour political rally for the president, something we've seen him do since he has been president. And again, not so much about the troops and their sacrifice, but more about him. He did try to reach out to the prime minister there. I think they had a conversation by phone, but the plans for officials, Iraqi officials, to meet with the president were scrapped. And now you have Iraqi officials saying that, hey, listen, you said you were going to pull out of Syria. You said you were going to draw down in Afghanistan. How about you get the heck out of here as well? And so now we've got a diplomatic row after the president's visit. I would say this was almost all but a disaster for the president. But, of course, he's going to look at it as a win-win.
Caleb, what does this say about the organization within the Oval Office in terms of the Office of Protocol and the other the forward advanced team who's supposed to manage this stuff? Because, again, as Colin mentioned, Iraqi Prime Minister Abdul Mahdi was invited to meet with the president only 2 hours in advance, so he wasn't able to make the event. They spoke over the phone, but the prime minister later said that the meeting was canceled because of a disagreement over how to conduct the session. According to Newsweek, Trump posed with members of a special operations unit for photographs and then posted a video, including the scene on Twitter, without blurring the faces of the SEAL team that he met with, and which is violates security protocol. And then there's some question about the troops who signed the mega hats that they may have violated DOD rules against active duty personnel engaging in, quote, partisan political activities, end quote. This sounds like a school of foolfish, as George Clinton would say. And a whole lot of folks don't really understand the details and nuts and bolts of how to get these things done and done properly.
The fact that the president would stage a political rally for himself with the military, that's something that anybody who's concerned about American democracy is going to be concerned about. Now, I mean, if you look at it, you know, there has been, and many have noted, an increasing politicization of you know, especially the upper ranks of the U.S. military. It used to be that, you know, they had no role in politics. But if you look at West Point, it's increasingly Republican, the role of evangelical ministers and such within the military. And the increasing rightward trend within the military itself, that's something that many left-wing commentators have commented on as kind of a strange turn in U.S. politics. And the fact that now there was a political rally staged, but there is also outrage, and it's pretty clear that a lot of the people at the top of the military, a lot of the generals, don't particularly care for Trump. So it raises some questions, and it fits in with a bigger trend. I wanted to touch on, though, it was asked why, you know, if he's going to pull the troops out of Syria, he's going to pull the troops out of Afghanistan, why not Iraq? Well, I think that, you know, his relationship with Netanyahu and his support, his anti-Iranian fanaticism and his alliance with the Netanyahu wing of Israeli politics has a lot to do with that. Because we saw on the campaign trail that Trump said that, quote, he had, you know, the USA had, quote, allowed Iran to take over Iraq. That's not the truth. The truth is, however, that Iraq, since the overthrow of the Ba'ath Arab Socialist government of Saddam Hussein, has been cast into chaos, and that Iraq has a Shiite Muslim majority, and there has been sectarian religious division, and the Shiite Muslim majority has turned to the Islamic Republic of Iran for support and for protection and for weapons and trying to protect themselves, while Saudi Arabia funds these Sunni extremists that want to kill Shia Muslims, and that there has been strife. And because of that, the Shia majority in Iraq has turned to Iran for support. And so for the USA to withdraw its forces from Iraq, he probably fears that that would enable Iranian influence in Iraq to grow. And I think that, you know, that Netanyahu, who sees Iran as the greatest evil in the region, would be furious with Donald Trump. And that Likud party wing, that seems to be particularly close to Donald Trump in their anti-Iranian obsession, would be deeply offended if Trump were to pull forces out. And I think that's why you got your answer there.
I got to stop you there. Let me say again to all three of you, Colin Campbell, Dr. Mamie Locke, and Caleb Maupin, I know each of you sacrificed time away from your families on a holiday to participate in this program, and I truly, truly appreciate it. I look forward to having you all back next year and wish you all a wonderful, wonderful weekend and a happy new year. Thank you all so much.
Happy new year to you as well.
Thank you.
Leon, happy new year, everyone.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. You've been listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I want to thank you all for allowing my voice into your space. Happy New Year. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here next year. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.